Yes, I understand that every life must end. As we sit alone, I know someday we must go.
Oh, I'm a lucky man to count on both hands the ones I love.
Some folks just have one, you know, others they've got none. Oh. Stay with me, oh, let's just breathe.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and it's time for our regular final thought segment. That's Willie Nelson's Just Breathe, and that's what we'll be using each and every time we do this segment. It's such a beautiful song. And in this segment, we hear final thoughts from people who are dying, and also final thoughts from folks about their loved ones, a eulogy, a written tribute, anything that stirs the souls. This week's final thoughts feature is a powerful one from Herb London, a former professor and dean at NYU, and the former president of the Hudson Institute. He's presently the president of the London Center for Policy Research and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Herb read for us his written tribute to his dad, Yonkel London, more familiarly known as Jack. The tribute is from Herb's book, The Overheated Decade, and was later republished in the Washington Post. Let's tune in to the first portion.
He was lying in a coma at St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City. The doctor said he was dying from a cerebral hemorrhage. I knew better. He was dying of obsolescence, of unfulfilled dreams, trapped in an age he no longer understood. He had been a survivor of the Depression, the product of an era when whatever you got, you earned. Little you had made no difference because everyone had little. You worked hard because that was the only way to get a little more. Nobody knew from trust funds. You learned about cleanliness by walking on the newspaper spread over your mother's freshly washed floor. When you got a present of any kind, even a spool without thread, you played with it for 2 weeks, kept it in your box of valuable possessions, along with bottle tops and baseball cards, and if your father consented, put it under your pillow before dreams about the gas house gang filled your thoughts. Loyalty to wife and family, appreciation for what you had, kindness, respect, cheerfulness, hard work, often beyond the requirements of the job, these were what counted. It was in the mid-1960s that the nightmare started. Suddenly, because you worked hard, you were called a slave. Because you were polite, you were obsequious. Even devotion to wife and children was not a virtue anymore. Some screaming woman claimed your devotion was subjugation. Cleanliness had magically become a false value. The dirty jeans you called shamatas or rags were worn as a uniform. Curse words you deplored were used even by your children's teachers. Because you wouldn't let your 18-year-old daughter have sex in her bedroom, you were called a hypocrite. Because you were nurtured on work and opposed welfare, you were a racist. What had happened to the world?
And already you're getting a real palpable sense for Herb's dad, who he was, and the times in which he lived and grew up. Let's continue with how Yonkel's voracious work ethic began at an early age.
By the time he was a teenager, Yonkel, or Jack, as some called him, had already had 4 jobs. He never knew his father, who was no good anyway, so he was forced to work to help his mother survive and to assist his older brother, Izzy, who was going to law school. At the height of the Depression, he got a job at a bookstore on 4th Avenue in Manhattan. The owner was so impressed with his diligence that he rewarded him with buying and selling responsibilities, in addition to dusting thousands of books. More responsibility didn't mean more money. After all, he had to be happy to have a job at all. When the owner was arrested and sent to Sing Sing for stealing a rare book, Yonkel ran the store by himself for 5 years, never taking an extra penny and traveling to the prison on his day off to present his employer with a complete ledger of sales and purchases. His additional compensation was the right to borrow several Dickens novels and a few books on psychology. They were always returned without a mark so that a future sale was possible. When his mother moved the family from Bayonne, New Jersey to Williamsburg section of Brooklyn, Yonkel walked 2 miles a day so that he could attend Boys High, then the center of adolescent Jewish intellectuals. His dream was to go to college, but as his mother always said, "Yonkel, we must help Izzy get through school first." So Yonkel educated himself in the bookstore, and every penny he earned went into the house. His only pleasure came from being on the track team for one semester and eating Charlotte Russe's on Delancey Street.
And we're getting a real picture now of Yonkel's life. And now we need to turn to the romantic part of his life and how he met his wife during the height of the Great Depression.
He was good looking, but he didn't go out very often. Who had time for girls? One evening on the Avenue U platform of the BMT subway, he met a girl with exquisite legs who paid him as much attention as the models on the billboards. But he wouldn't take no for an answer. After months of pursuit, mostly with romantic correspondence, he married the girl in a simple ceremony. He had no money, and she had even less. To make matters worse, he lost his job 2 days after the wedding. Still, they picked up and went on a honeymoon to Lakewood, New Jersey for the weekend. They were 21 and 20, in the middle of a depression, unemployed, without an apartment of their own, but with pride and faith in one another.
And when we come back, we're going to hear more from Herb London, his eulogy to his father, Yonkel. And this is Our American Stories, our final thought segment. More after these messages. American Stories. It's our final thought segment. And let's pick up where we left off. Herb London on his father, Yonkel. The last clip ended with these two young kids getting married at the height of the Depression and Yonkel losing his job 2 days after their wedding. But Herb said they did have something, and that was pride and faith in one another. Faith that paid dividends, faith that they desperately need.
The first job that became available with the help of friends was at a dry goods store selling sweaters. The owner, a man named Zuckerman, had all the charm of Simon Legree and Scrooge combined, except that he was less generous. But Yonkel was good at selling and knew it. The customers began to say, "Let Yonkel serve me." Yet Yonkel went nowhere. When he mustered enough courage to ask for a raise, Zuckerman replied, "You want a raise? I'll lift you off the chair." World War II made some decisions for Yonkel. Since he had a newborn child by then, he was given the choice of an Anzio beachhead or the Wright Aeronautical Company, so he spent the war making propellers for B-24s. Each morning at 5 a.m., he would kiss his wife on the forehead, flex the arms that held his colicky child all night, and took off for the swamps of New Jersey. There was never any complaining. He did his part, and he didn't expect any medals. Being free from the fumes of Secaucus would be sufficient reward. During the war, Jack had taken a part-time job with a firm marketing plastic material that resembled leather, if your eyesight was 400 by 400, to pay the rent on the two-room apartment they had moved to in Brighton Beach. In 1945, when he left Wright, he continued to work full-time at the fake leather company. It wasn't much of a job, but it wasn't Zuckerman either. Actually, he didn't have much of a choice. He wasn't eligible for the GI Bill to complete the BA degree that had begun at Brooklyn and then City College. He had no experience that could be turned into a higher-paying job, and he had a family to support. The fake leather company was a family firm where the brothers sat on their hands and provided sinecures for their children who sat on their hands. But Jack didn't care who did the work and who got the rewards. He loved his work. After years of lifting plastic rolls and taking orders, he was promoted to salesman. He saw it as an extraordinary event. On your own to sell a product and yourself. Before long, his customers were less concerned with his product and more concerned with him. Jack, what do you say? How's your bright son? Is your wife feeling okay? He would reply in Yiddish or Italian or Russian, depending on his customer's language of choice. He knew about their kids, their financial problems, their girlfriends on the side. His dedication to his work was never equivocal. Yankel, I've never seen anyone so devoted to a business. You must be one of the family. But not only wasn't he in the family, he never received a commission or inflated his expenses. He was probably the only salesman in the country who worked without commission and didn't think it was necessary. They're not bad fellows. I'm sure they'll do okay by me, he would say on the rare occasion when his wife would ask about his salary. The years slipped away for him. There were improvements in his life, but by any dispassionate measure, he was falling way behind.
And next, Jack and his family would find a better place to live, and Jack would find something every working man needs, a hobby.
He moved from the two-room flat to an apartment in Queens. Now that his son was 12, it was somewhat more difficult for husband, wife, and child to sleep in the same bedroom. The place in Kew Gardens Hills wasn't really much, but the cockroaches hadn't yet invaded. His son wasn't rolled for dimes on his way to school, and the subway ride to Manhattan was somewhat shorter. The rent of $99 a month was three times what he had paid before, but his wife and son rarely made financial demands. They believed, as did Jack, that Queens was the promised land. To help him get to new customers on Long Island, Jack asked for and received a loan to buy a car. For him, it wasn't an ordinary automobile desired for its function. It was superordinated into the realization of a fantasy. He had his own car. It was a special possession which required cleaning three times a day. When Jack wasn't working or attending to family responsibilities, he was, as his wife would say, pitching the car. As a kid, he had hardly any toys. The one toy gun and holster he got as a Hanukkah present, he kept in perfect working order until he was 17. His suits and jackets were lined up like toy soldiers in his closet, and each shirt in his dresser was separated from the others by tissue paper to avoid any possibility of creasing. But the car was his prize. When passers-by would see it, they would always ask how he got that shine. The answer was simple. He Simonized his car every single day. When he saw young people deal capriciously with possessions, he would say, they have too much. They just don't know how much sweat went into getting it.
They have too much. I could hear my grandparents saying that from the grave still. Let's continue with Herb London's recounting of his father, Yankel, a.k.a. Jack's life.
His son became something of a basketball jock, yet he responded with the same equanimity to his son's success as his own anonymity. Sure, he was proud, but it was more important not to let high school fame go to his son's head. Whether the boy performed well or didn't, he always had a good thing to say. So you didn't score 20 points tonight. There will be other games and other opportunities. It was wisdom he could apply to others, but not to himself. When opportunity called, as it often did, he was reluctant to act. How can I take a chance? After all, the company has a pension and profit-sharing plan for me. I'm not doing so badly.
Did you hear that? Yankel put his family's future above his own dreams and ambitions. And folks, that happens every day here in American life. We so often celebrate the entrepreneur on this show, and we do and should, but it can be just as challenging, maybe even more so, to not pursue one's dreams for the sake of the family, to not take that risk, because you have bigger and more personal responsibilities to attend to. As Yankel said, I'm not doing so badly. Well, does his son Herb think he was right?
His judgment, though, is illusory. Living at the economic margin, he could not escape the encroachment of ghetto conditions. His garden apartment in the promised land became overrun with the ubiquitous flies around the garbage cans, rumors of robbery, scratches on his prized car, and neighbors who had no pride in their own appearance, much less the appearance of their residences. He tried to escape, but he couldn't keep pace with inflation and the sprawl of urban problems. Where can you go when you haven't gotten a raise in 3 years and inflation is at 10% a year? He moved to the Left Rack City apartment complex and for the first time in years was genuinely happy about his home, even though his son, who was teaching at the time, had to contribute part of his salary so that the rent could get paid. The place was clean, his neighbors pleasant, and there are always people around to talk about everything from the merits of turtle wax to national politics. But this condition was also ephemeral. With the number of welfare recipients spiraling at a mind-boggling rate during the Lindsay years, and with apartment space at a premium, it was only a matter of time before the city administration would subsidize welfare families at Left Rack City. With that decision, Jack's world crumbled again, as did his faith in liberal politics. It wasn't that he was a racist, but when the newcomers came in large numbers, so did crime, chicken bones on the stairwells, crude language, and graffiti on the walls. But that wasn't the worst of it. Welfare recipients next door lived in an apartment larger than his, received rent subsidies, food stamps, and free medical care, paid no taxes, received a regular dole, and if his New York Times was accurate, had an annual income based on total aid of $11,500. Jack paid his rent properly, rarely ate out because he couldn't afford it, didn't qualify for free emergency care in a public hospital because he lived in a one-bedroom apartment, paid his taxes, and earned an annual salary of $11,000 with a take-home pay of $159 a week. Moreover, he didn't demonstrate, was always polite, clean, and courteous. Yet no one gave a damn about him. Not the Lindsays, not even the Beams. He voted ritualistically, if not enthusiastically, for Democratic candidates. But in his gut, he knew no one represented his situation.
The forgotten man, in the end, Herb London, letting us all remember. Yankel London, this is our final thoughts series. When we come back, the end of this great and stirring eulogy. Son to father, after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and it's time for the final part of this stirring eulogy, Herb London, to his father, Yankel. And this is a part of our final thought series, love, death, life itself, every aspect of it. We cover it here in Our American Stories, and this we think is the most important part, actually. A eulogy may be the most important piece of writing you ever do in your life. And my goodness, I can bet you anything that Herb would agree with that. In the last segment, we heard about how government welfare devalued Yankel's life and his relentless labor while giving nicer apartments in his building to those who didn't work at all. Yanka would become weary about the government who was supposed to represent him too, Herb tells us.
And he became more and more reactionary and jaundiced about all politicians. As far as he was concerned, his hard-earned tax dollars were being squandered on foreign wars with no apparent purpose, on people who returned the favor with insults, and on corporations who were already corpulent beyond his comprehension. He couldn't understand the new attitude toward the work ethic, which he called institutional laziness. He watched postal employees work at so slow a pace it defied biology. He and four others like him could make the system efficient in a week. He couldn't understand why it took two construction workers to carry a 2x4, or why university professors didn't work more than 12 hours a week. If he had a job to do, even if it were as insignificant as cleaning a closet, he did it with more zest than the entire Berkeley population could muster for a sit-in at the Bank of America. Despite his emotionally conservative views, he was hardly an Archie Bunker. Yet he was the serious side of Bunker that few give serious attention to. Long before it was fashionable, he recognized the corrosive influence of welfare. Even if he were in an iron lung, welfare of any kind would be inconceivable. He had too much pride to take anything from anyone without a service rendered.
And despite him receiving no help or representation, Jack did not hesitate in helping others or being there for others.
Yet there was a soft side to his hard-nosed values. Irving, of course I'll ask my son how Howie can get into NYU. Sylvia, you can borrow my vacuum cleaner for a month for as long as you like. He walked around Left Rack City like the town crier. He knew every neighbor's name and the first name of every kid in the family. He helped to push cars out of snowdrifts and carry grocery packages for old women. Everyone knew Jack. Since he had come from a broken home, he devoted himself to his family with an unparalleled passion. Because his wife was often ill, he did all of the shopping, cleaning, and dishwashing. He was certainly not sympathetic to the feminist movement. He was simply in love with his wife. After 38 years of marriage, with divorce rates increasing and those staying married cursing at one another unmercifully, Jack actually loved his wife. When his son told him that he had separated from his own wife, Jack cried. He couldn't understand it. Why are you separating? Do you hate her? No, if not, why? When his son suggested that he go away for his two-week vacation, he replied, why should you go away? I'll walk on the Long Beach, hold hands, and sit on the boardwalk. When he wasn't doing things for his wife and son, he was busy trying to keep his grandchildren happy. Pom-Pom, their name for him. Be a horsey. Pom-Pom, would you please get us chocolate ice cream? He never refused. When the temperatures were cold enough to hang icicles on his mustache, he went out for chocolate ice cream with sprinkles. Yankel, where are you going on a night like this? His friends would ask. My grandchildren are here.
And we now go to the final portion of Herb London's tribute to his father, Jack, and this again for our final thought series.
Last August, he celebrated his 60th birthday. It was eventful only because he talked about the possibility of retiring. I'll get my pension funds and profit-sharing money and go to Florida. From August through November, he beseeched his employers for the money. Yankel, they would say, it's coming, it's coming. But I've waited 32 years for a little something. If I have to wait any longer, I won't live to enjoy it. He was almost right. At the end of the year, the company called a meeting to dissolve the employee fund. Jack anticipated a sizable check. He had high hopes, even though for years he had received nothing but empty promises. That morning he told his wife, "This is the day," and it was. At the meeting, the split was announced. For undisclosed reasons, the kind of check Jack had come to believe would be his was not. Moreover, another employee who had been with the firm only a year longer was to receive $8,000 more from the plan, again for unexplained reasons. Jack left the meeting pale. Several minutes later, one of his fellow employees asked, "Jack, why are you dragging your leg?" He didn't know what was happening. An hour later, he lost all feeling on his side. When his son went with him to the hospital, he said two things. don't tell Mom about this, and straighten my tie before I go into the hospital. People like Jack don't die easily. They can't cope with the times, but they go down fighting. Their standards are the only shield they have against the onslaught of existential happiness at any price. I knew he was dying, lying in that coma at St. Vincent's, but I just wanted him to wake one more time so I could tell him I loved him. He was my father, and his kind won't be seen anymore. Herb London.
And thank you, Herb, for that. And for anybody listening, just grab a tissue or something. It's just beautiful. And, you know, he'd said something interesting when he dug into that Archie Bunker stereotype. You know, Norman Lear was up to something pretty remarkable in making that show, but he was also doing something pretty nasty. Anybody who thought a certain way about the state of welfare was pigeonholed into some kind of Archie Bunker racist. And one thing we know about Herb London and his dad, particularly liberal Jews of that generation, anything from the truth. And Norman Lear knows better. And it was a nasty thing for him to do with all in the family and with that character. And he knew exactly what he was doing. And that still exists today, that sort of thought police, to put into some character who holds an opinion different than yours, some ugly motivation, some level of stupidity. And my goodness, we learn from Herb London the unfairness of what he saw. And actually, in the end, the waste, and the sadness of it all. What a life, what a job. And this is Our American Stories, and that's our final thought segment. And we'd love to hear your final thought stories. Give us a call at 844-627-8255 and record your story there, or leave us your information if you're not comfortable doing that, and we can help you record it. Once again, that's 844-627-8255. If you've written a eulogy, if you've come across a good eulogy, share it with us. I think there's no better way to share an American life than through that kind of storytelling. It's both sad, but it's also beautiful. And my goodness, I think I've learned a little bit about myself listening to that piece. And I hear my grandfather, and I hear that entire generation of Depression-era folks who did so much with so little. And we do so often in this generation, so little with so much. This is Our American Stories. And go to ouramericannetwork.org and listen to Tony Dolan's eulogy about his father, Joe. Tony was the chief speechwriter for Ronald Reagan for 8 years, and he wrote some of the most memorable speeches we've all ever heard. But this was his most memorable piece of writing, the eulogy to his father, Joe. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we regularly like to go to the Wall Street Journal, and sometimes for their opinion writers, but sometimes, well, The Burning Question is one of our favorites, and you've heard Heidi Mitchell before talk about many interesting things, and today I think maybe one of the most interesting of all of the subjects, and this burning question this week is, does having a baby really make it harder to concentrate? And Heidi, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my My pleasure.
And by the way, we were just in a conversation just offline, and it was like, look, I know I wrote about something, and hold on a second, and there it is. I almost said, there's the column right there. Heidi, you are having a hard time concentrating because you have three kids. You've got two away in camp and one away in another camp. And talk about your personal experience of this burning question before we get into the actual science of this, Heidi.
Well, I think, you know, it's a sort of misconception that, you know, something called mommy brain, right? It's like this fogginess that you feel like you're being pulled in so many directions when you, it's not just when you have babies, though, it's when you have kids in general, and fathers feel it too, right? You know, it's hard to focus on work when something important is going on with your kid, and I think we all feel that way. But your brain's super adaptive, and we've evolved for many generations, and so have other animals. And there's lots of evidence out there that say that maybe not definitively proved, but lots of evidence to show that maybe having your kids doesn't make it harder to concentrate. Maybe it just feels that way, but it makes you better at some things.
Yeah, you know, I once heard, it was a unique little autobiography. Judge Ginsburg was being interviewed, and she talked about having a child while she was in her first year at Harvard. Her husband then moved to Columbia. She went with him. And she talked about the fact that having a child actually focused her more. She had to get home and take care of the child, so she had this tremendous focus in her study time because she wanted to get to that child. And she also said that, in a sense, it made her an adult, and it took her away from the worries of the traditional law student. And it was fascinating to hear that from someone like Judge Ginsburg, who, by the way, when she was at Columbia, was one of just several women in the entire class, Heidi.
The notorious RBJ.
And that's
RBG.
Right, the notorious RBG. That's right. So tell me this, Heidi. What are the earliest changes to a woman's brain even before the baby is born?
So it's important to think about the idea of becoming a parent. And this also affects men, too, and we can talk about that later. But, you know, you start to become a parent biologically and neurologically well before the child comes out of you. So I like to refer to it as a fetus. But as this fetus is growing inside of you, your brain structure is increasing. So it's sort of like the lattice work that holds it up is getting stronger and bigger. And certain parts of the brain show that, including the part of the brain that focuses on executive function, which is like making decisions and focus and, you know, making good choices. And they see evidence of this, you know, 3 or 4 months after birth. So it's happening, you know, not until, you know, the fetus is a few months old, but you know, there's different hormones that are going on through your body. Of course, there's things growing inside of you, and your brain is adapting to all that, is getting ready to not take care of just itself, but also to this other thing that's going to come out of you.
And, you know, there's a talk in the column about the higher function of the brain when a mom is pregnant and has multiple pregnancies. You also talk about how moms are anxious and under pressure simultaneously. And how does that change their brains?
So, you know, when your new mothers tend to be super anxious because, you know, you're not used to taking care of yourself and this other thing, right? You have no idea what you're doing.
Right.
And you're always worried about your baby's health. So that idea of mommy brain could be that you're distracted because, you know, you feel like your brain doesn't have enough capacity to both think about all your child's needs and take care of your child's needs and take care of all of your own needs. But as the notorious RBG has shown, you know, you want to get all your work done really well the first time so that you can leave at 6 o'clock and get home to nurse your baby or whatever it is. So that anxiety should diminish as you realize, oh, I can do this, you know. And then there's been some evidence, there haven't been studies done on humans, but animal research has shown that multiple pregnancies can maybe even increase that ability to kind of juggle that idea. So not the fog, let's ignore that, but this idea of juggling and being able to do lots of things. I think it was rodents showed that after multiple pregnancies that they had a better time remembering where they hid their food, and that is the main thing they need to do for their baby. Is to remember where to find the food, source the food, and store it somewhere where no one's going to find it.
Yep.
And they have shown that they, increased pregnancies has increased capacity for memory. So if we can extrapolate from that, then, well, maybe we're even smarter after we've had a baby.
Well, I think I am, and that's what I want to segue over to the men. Let's take a listen first, Heidi, to Louis C.K. talking about life with a baby.
She woke me up all night. Just woke me up every 10 minutes. Just woke me up. Just said, "Dad," with nothing. That's the worst part. "Daddy! Whoa, what is it?" "You got nothing." So now it's the next morning. I'm making breakfast and I'm gone. I'm insane. I drank too much coffee to overcompensate. And I'm like, I keep having these moments where it's like, and there's nothing there. Just nothing. Okay.
So that could be daddy brain. Is daddy anxious too? Talk about daddy brain.
Daddy is anxious too, yeah. So the brain activity that's been studied, it shows that it's less in new fathers than in new mothers, but it is still affected, especially the part of the brain that's the parental instinct. So this idea of him going like, "What?" waking up and just hearing the baby go say anything, I mean, that's for real. Dad, there's chemical changes in the dad brains that they are responding to being a parent, this new role. And the brain is creating these new connections all the time and getting smarter, getting better, recognizing, you know how I say that you can tell, oh, that cry means she's hungry and that cry means she's got a wet diaper. And like, you start to kind of learn that, but that's not something you knew 6 months before, right? So your brain's really adaptive. And also they show that men and women have an increase of oxytocin, which is, you know, a love hormone. So men have a little bit less. Women have more, especially if they breastfeed, but it's this kind of feel-good hormone. So, you know, even though you're anxious and you're stressed out and you're juggling, you may have a little bit of euphoria because you're so in love with this new thing that you've created. And so I think the positives seem to outweigh the negatives in most senses. And I always say, if I'm hiring somebody, oh my God, I'm probably not allowed to say this out loud, but a new parent may not be such a bad person to hire.
No.
They're probably like, really want to get home and want to get the work done right. They don't want to lose their job. And so, you know, all of the stakes are much higher now. And so, you know, they might be a really good employee.
You bet. And you know what I think they don't want to do? I don't think they want to waste time, Heidi. And if there's anything in an office that messes up everything, it's people who waste time because they've got no life. And so they ruin yours.
Right. The other thing is, you know, you might feel more confident after you, like, I always felt like, in fact, I went back to work early. I didn't take the full maternity leave with my first kid because I just couldn't be alone with this kid anymore. Bless his heart. But I just needed to be around grownups. And work was something I totally understood. Like, I got it. I get this. You people are sane. You respond in an adult-like manner to requests. And then you go home to like this chaos of, I don't know what you mean. And like the laundry is not done and the breakfast is still out and all that stuff. But your brain is so adaptive. It's like plastic and it just changes and grows. And you can be better at work. You can be less chit-chatty, or you can like know how to move through that water cooler conversation really fast. You can get back to the job so you can get in that car, commute back home.
You bet. You know, Heidi, are these mommy and daddy brain changes temporary, or is there something more lasting going on here?
It's actually pretty lasting. I mean, that the anxiety tends to go away as you get used to, you know, you get more confident. But the structure of the brain, it's like scaffolding, and it's kind of growing, and it means maybe not permanent because it can go away if you have some sort of head injury or drugs or something else like that. But once you make these connections, we're always talking about the brain's connections. Once you make them, they're there. And so it becomes, the pathway is just much faster. So where it used to take you, you know, a minute or 30 seconds to make a decision about something, it now takes you 3 seconds because you've done it 100 times before. And so that's like a permanent, you know, rapid fire response. Those executive functions, those quick decisions, emotional responses, those things they're just quicker. So yeah, permanent, semi-permanent, pretty permanent.
Well, that's all good news for all of you who have kids and are wondering about whether having a baby really makes it harder to concentrate? I think there's an answer there, I think. Kinda, sorta, in a good way. Heidi, thanks so much for joining us, as always.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Does having a baby really make it harder to concentrate? And it's our burning question with columnist Heidi Mitchell of the Wall Street Journal. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to see all of our work together. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and we love to do This Days in History, always brought to you by Hillsdale College. And on this day in history, a legend was born. Melvin James Kaminsky, Mel Brooks. And he turned 90 today. He was born in 1926. An American actor, comedian, filmmaker, composer, songwriter, and veteran, as we'll learn soon. And my goodness, his work, American classics. The Producers may be the funniest movie ever made. 12 Chairs, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, Silent Movie, High Anxiety, History of the World, Part 1, Spaceballs, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and of course the musical adaptation of his first film, The Producers, ran on Broadway for 6 years and won... Well, it won the Tony, it won many Tonys, and it was just superb. And we wanted to start off the telling of this life. We like to always start these things off at the same place when we can, and that's at the beginning. Here's Mel talking with Marc Maron on his podcast about how he and his three brothers were raised by their single mom after their father died of tuberculosis.
Well, it was kind of screwed up and wonderful at the same time. My father passed away. He died. Like, I was on a show once, and the announcer who was interviewing me said, "So, when you were only 2 and a half or so, and you lost your father," and I took a pause. I said, "No." He was dead. He wasn't lost. We knew just where he was. He was in the back. And finally they took him away and they put him in some cemetery. But we never lost him. We were never that careless with our father. Yeah, we cared about him. He died on January 14th, 1929. I'm very good with dates and things. My mother, Kitty, raised 4 boys. You know, those days, diapers. You had to wash them. I'll never forget one time I wanted to see... a movie, and she gave me 3 deposit bottles. So that was 9 cents. You needed a dime. And she went to, went next door to Mrs. Miller and borrowed a penny so I could make the dime. But she was, I don't know whether she was typical, but she was a wonderful, loving, caring, one beautiful mother.
Indeed. And, this is the way of comics, turning something tragic into something humorous. His father died of kidney disease at 34 when Brooks was 2 years old. He has said of his father's death, quote, "There's an outrage there. I may be angry at God or at the world for that. And I'm sure a lot of my comedy is based in some way on anger and hostility." And by the way, he was born in Brooklyn, and that's that borough in New York that produces so many comic greats. And his father's family were Jews from Danzig, Germany, His mother's family were Jews from Kiev. And this will become important as we learn a little bit more about how the producers got made. And from that same podcast, Mel here talks to Marc Maron about how much he could buy back in those days when he was a kid with a mere 50 cents.
My brother Lenny used to give me a half a buck on Saturday night. I mean, that was a veritable fortune, literally. I mean, a half a buck. You could go, you could start in a delicatessen. You could have two frankfurters with sauerkraut. You could have it with beans and with French fries, with a Dr. Brown cream or celery. That whole thing was about a quarter. Then you could go to the movies, and yeah. I think that was about 20 cents, you know, or 15 cents. I don't know. The movie wasn't much. And after it, you had a dime left for the ice cream parlor. Half a buck, a whole night out. I mean, I was deliriously happy.
From an American Masters documentary, here is Mel talking about how his mother wanted him to become an aviation mechanic.
I was 14. My mother found out about Heron High School of Aviation Trades, which is in Brooklyn, and taught you to be in their four-year high school program an aviation mechanic. And I said, well, okay, sounds good, you know? We'll see how it goes, but at least my mother knew a trade is something. You'll have a job. You'll be able to marry and eat and have a family. My brother Irving gets home. It's about 11 o'clock at night from Brooklyn College. And he said, well, what is that? What is this form? And my mother explained. He said, well, your mind and your heart is in the right place, Mom. But this kid is special. He's really bright. And I think we've got to give him a chance to really go somewhere. And as he's tearing it up, he says, he's not going to be an aviation mechanic. My mother said, all right, I tried, you know. And to this day, I think Irving made a mistake, and I made a mistake, because had I gone to Heron High School of Aviation Trades and become an aviation mechanic, I'd be retired now with a very good pension. I'd be relaxed. My feet would be up. A lovely neighbor, nice guy, you know. Hey, Saul, how you doing, Al? Going good. Watch the hedges. Keep them even.
Keep them even. Here's Mel talking to Conan O'Brien about how he knew this kid from Brooklyn that he was headed straight to the Garment Center, because that's where everybody that he grew up with ended up working in New York City.
I knew I was headed for the Garment Center. I just knew. I was like, it was destiny. Everybody in those tenements, it was like a sci-fi movie. We were all robotically destined to end up on 7th Avenue, either cutters or shipping clerks or sometimes salesmen. But we were all heading for the Garment Center, which was the real industry in New York.
Well, when we come back, there's a little detour in Mel Kaminsky's life, Mel Brooks, a little something called World War II. And then thereafter, how he ends up landing, not in the Garment District, but on Broadway in New York and then Los Angeles to make some of the funniest movies ever made. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Story. This day in history, Mel Brooks was born. This is Our American Stories, the life of Mel Brooks, celebrated here on this day in history. Mel Brooks was born Melvin James Kaminsky in 1926. He turns 90 today. And we learn in Brooks's career that detour he took was a tough one. And he spent a year after graduating from high school at Brooklyn College as a psychology major before being drafted into the Army. He attended the Army Specialized Training Program conducted at the Virginia Military Institute, although not actually as a VMI cadet, and then served in the United States Army as a corporal in the 1104 Engineer Combat Battalion, 78th Infantry Division, defusing landmines. Ouch. That's about as rough as it gets. Let's take a listen to Mike Rowe, who did a really neat story and performed this on his podcast, celebrating Brooks's life.
Corporal Kaminsky was precariously perched atop a makeshift utility pole 40 feet above the frozen ground. In the dim light of a crescent moon, he squinted to complete his task and tried not to lose his battle with gravity. As a member of the 1104th Engineer Combat Group, Kaminsky was used to such work. What he was not used to was doing it so close to the enemy. You see, this particular pole to which this particular 18-year-old corporal clung was planted in Belgium, specifically in the Ardennes Forest. And just through the trees, a big chunk of the German army was regrouping after their enormous offensive that would be remembered forever as the Battle of the Bulge. They were so close, Kaminsky could smell them. An odorous stew of bratwurst, gasoline, and boiled cabbage filled his nostrils. You could hear them, too. They'd been playing propaganda recordings all night long, an unholy mix of the German national anthem, the latest ravings of the mad Führer, and the sweet English voice of Axis Sally urging our boys to lay down their guns and surrender. As he twisted the last wire around the screw that would carry the current to a slightly different broadcast, he heard a harsh whisper from the sentry below him. "This isn't funny, Kaminsky." This made the young corporal smile. If there was one thing he'd learned growing up on the mean streets of Brooklyn, it was this. Whenever anyone said, "That's not funny," it was almost certain to be hilarious. Kaminsky shimmied down the pole, took one last glance up at the enormous loudspeaker he'd just installed, and giggled. The sentry shook his head as Kaminsky scurried back to battalion command. Along the way, he stepped around numerous foxholes filled with exhausted and freezing GIs. Their spirits needed a lift, and by golly, he was just the soldier to do the job. Kaminsky searched through a small box of vinyl 78s, looking for just the perfect selection for an occasion such as this. His eyes settled on a classic, and Kaminsky giggled once again. A switch was flipped, a dial was cranked, and a wall of sound erupted from Kaminsky's loudspeaker that echoed through the frozen forest. In an instant, the racist rantings of Adolf Hitler were drowned out by the unmistakable refrain known to millions. "Tut tut tootsie, goodbye. Tut tut tootsie, don't cry." For several glorious and confusing minutes, the only thing the soldiers on either side could hear were the dulcet tones of the one and only Al Jolson, who, like Corporal Kaminsky, just happened to be very, very Jewish. Kaminsky watched as the war-torn boys of the 78th poked their heads out of their foxholes like curious prairie dogs. The absurdity of the situation took a few moments to process, but soon the irony washed over the troops and the laughter set in. Nazis, in the middle of a war, driven by an insane hatred of Jews, were now being serenaded by one. Now that was funny. I guess if you can make people laugh on the battlefields of Europe, you can make people laugh pretty much anywhere. And that had always been Corporal Kaminsky's goal.
And again, that Corporal Kaminsky would soon change his name after the war as he started to work the circuit in the Borscht Belt resorts and nightclubs in the Catskill Mountains north of New York City, as a drummer by all accounts, trained by Buddy Rich, by the way, who grew up in his neighborhood, and pianist. And it was, again, at this time that he changed his name to Mel Brooks. Here is Mel talking about why and how he got into show business, and that it was really based on a pretty gigantic mistake.
There was kind of like a giant mistake, you know, that happened. We had, in our neighborhood, we had a celebrity. We had an actor. His name was Don Appel. Don was in a play on Broadway called Native Son with a great actor called Canada Lee, who was a, and it was a really, it was a beautiful play, and Don was one of the stars, Don Appel, of Native Son on Broadway. And he'd come home every night, and a few of us, two or three of us, would stay up and wait for him. He didn't get there till 11:30, till, you know, sometimes midnight. And we'd be in Mr. Shanus, that was the grocery man's milk box, waiting for him, because we knew he'd show up at the milk box to tell us what happened that night, if somebody died in the audience or coughed or whatever.
Yeah.
And he'd regale us with stories of makeup and backstage, tell you everything. And we were just, we were thrilled. And then, and there were only two of us, Joe Gavanter and me, and we decided that's where we're going. We're going backstage. We're going to be, we're going to put on makeup. We're going to entertain.
We're going to entertain. And that was it. He comes back from the war, as I said. He goes up to the Catskills, and he starts doing his thing. After a regular comic at one of the nightclubs there was too sick to perform one night, Brooks started working as a stand-up, telling jokes and doing movie star impressions. He also began acting in summer stock in Red Bank, New Jersey. He also dabbled in radio. He eventually worked his way up to comically aggressive job of tumbler, master entertainer, at the legendary Grossinger's, one of the Borscht Belt's most famous resorts. By the way, a lot of New York producers and those types went up to vacation there, and so everybody wanted that gig at Grossinger's because maybe they'd be discovered. And Brooks found more rewarding work soon behind the scenes, becoming a comedy writer for television. In 1949, he got his big break. His friend Sid Caesar hired Brooks to write jokes for the NBC series The Admiral Broadway Review, paying him a monstrous $50 a week. In 1950, Caesar created the revolutionary variety comedy series Your Show of Shows and hired Brooks as a writer, along with these writers, Neil Simon. Did anyone write bigger hit Broadway plays? Danny Simon, Mel Tolkien, and he met a lifelong partner, Carl Reiner, in that writer's room. Here's Mel Brooks talking to Conan O'Brien about Sid Caesar's great talent.
He said, home, parce que vous avez dit avec les autres choses. And the waiter knew that there was some French there, but but he couldn't make any sense out of it, you know.
Right,
he,
right.
He kept saying, en anglais, and took English, I take your order, and Sid never stopped. Sid was relentless. Oh, parce que vous avez dit les autres choses.
Carnivalous, geschmutzigt, und was die Ausgekleidung du bist, so dass er das Craziness verschmutzigt ist.
Ja, ich hat gereistet.
Ja?
Ja?
Jetzt gefällt es dir, mach dir mal, mach Manikel Spick und Spähen.
Ja.
Gut. Ach, das ist schlipprig von der Schleife jetzt.
And that was Sid Caesar doing his gibberish, and he would just pretend to talk in a foreign language, but he was making it up. And Brooks learned so much from Sid, a giant in the business. Indeed, he came on Conan that night, because Conan was one of the rare new young talents who paid homage properly to Sid Caesar. Mel Brooks was so taken by that that he came on soon thereafter to thank Conan for treating this elder statesman of comedy with the proper respect and reverence he deserved and earned. And when we come back, we're going to dig into that partnership that we talked about before. Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks, and the 2,000-year-old man. And then after that, the producers. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Mel Brooks, celebrated this day in history in 1926, 90 years ago. Mel Brooks was born.
missed it by that much.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Story, celebrating the life of Mel Kaminsky. Mel Brooks, that is. Changed his name when he went to the Catskills. And we're playing that music from Get Smart, because this is a brainchild of Mel Brooks and Buck Henry. And they wanted to create a show about a bumbling James Bond. As Brooks explained to a TV guide, "I was sick of looking at all those nice, sensible situation comedies. They were such distortions of life. I wanted to do a crazy, zany, unreal comic strip kind of thing about something besides a family. No one had ever done a show about an idiot before. I wanted to be the first." And it was truly a show about an idiot. And that's the thing about Brooks. As brilliant as he was, he loved the zany. And the zany really began for him when he started playing around doing improvisational comedy at people's homes around a 2,000-year-old man. Carl Reiner played the straight man, Mel Brooks the 2,000-year-old man. And they kept doing it at first for friends, but by the late 50s, it had gained a cult status in New York City. Indeed, Kenneth Tynan, one of the prominent critics then, saw the comedy duo perform it at a party in 1959, and he actually wrote a review. That's how good it was. And then again, he did it and performed it, and then they performed it some more on the Steve Allen Show, and then they recorded it, and it just sold. And then they recorded another and another, and it ultimately became a 1975 animated TV special. But enough about the 2,000-year-old man. Let's take a listen.
About 4 days ago, a plane landed at Idlewild Airport. The plane came from the Middle East, bearing a man who claims to be 2,000 years old. He spent the last 6 days at the Mayo Clinic. "Sir, is it true that you are 2,000 years old?"
"Oh, boy." "Yes."
"You are it's hard to believe, sir, because in the history of man, nobody's ever lived more than 167 years, as the man from Peru would claim to be. But you claim to be 2,000.
"Yes, I'm not yet. I'll be 2000 October 16th.
Yes. You will be 2000. When were you born?
We didn't have formal years and names in writing. We didn't know.
I see. And what?
Nobody kept time then. See, we didn't know. We didn't write. We just sat around. We pointed in the sky and we said, 'Whoa, hot boy,' you know."
"That's all you said?"
"We didn't even know it was the sun. We thought..."
"You mean you really didn't know
we
anything?"
"We didn't know anything. We were so dumb and stupid."
"Sir..."
"We didn't know who was a lady."
"But they were..."
"Hundreds of... They was with us. We didn't know who they were." "We didn't know who was the ladies and who was fellas.
You thought it was... They were just different type of
fellas."
"Yes,
just stronger or smaller or softer. The softer ones, I think, were ladies all the time."
How did you find out they were ladies?
"A cute fat guy could have mistaken him for a lady, you know? Soft and cute."
"Who was the person who discovered the female?"
"Bernie."
"Who was Bernie?"
"Bernie, one of the first leaders of our group."
"And he discovered the female."
"Yes."
"How did it happen?
He
How did
said,
it come
hey,
to pass?"
There's ladies here."
"I'm very interested to find out how Bernie discovered the woman."
"Well, he..."
"How did it come to pass?"
"He, one morning, he got up smiling." "So he said, 'I think there's ladies here.'" "So I said, 'What do you mean, you know?' So he said, 'Because in the night, I was thrilled and delighted, see?'" "So then he went into such a story that it's hundreds of years later, I still blushed."
"Sir, could you give us the secret of your longevity?"
"Well, the major thing is that I never, ever touch fried food. I don't eat it, I wouldn't look at it, and I don't touch it. And they never run for a bus, there'll always be another. Even if you're late from work, you know, I never run for a bus, I never ran, I just strolled jaunty, jolly, walking to the bus stop, you know?"
"Yeah, well, there were no buses in the time
no,
of
in my hurrah. In my time, I mean..."
"What was the means of transportation then?"
"Mostly fear."
Fear transported you?
Fear, yes. You would see an animal would growl, you would go 2 miles in a minute.
But I suppose you had...
Fear would be the main propulsion.
Yes, but I think most people are interested in living a long and fruitful life as
yes.
you have. You mentioned...
Fruit is good, too. You mentioned fruit. Fruit kept me going for 140 years once when I was on a very strict diet, mainly nectarines. I love that fruit. It's a half a peach, half a plum, but it's a hell of a fruit. I love it. Not too cold, not too hot, you know, just nice.
What has been
Even
your...
a rotten one is good. I love it. That's how much I love them. I'd rather eat a rotten nectarine than a fine plum. What do you think of that?
I can understand that.
Yes, that's how much I love them.
Yes, I can understand that.
Yes,
sir?
Some good things.
Sir, what did you do for a living?
Well, many years ago, thousands of years ago, there was no heavy industry.
We know that.
The most things that we manufactured or we made, the most things that we ever made was we would make, take a piece of wood, see, and rub it and rub it and clean it and look at it and hit earth with it and hit a tree with it.
For what purpose?
Just to keep busy. There was nothing.
Just to keep busy. And it goes on and on and on. And this was improvised and improvised over and over and over again. And this began this incredible career. Again, Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner's 2,000-year-old man. And we're going to pick up a little bit more where we left off. And then when we come back in the next segment, we are going to dig into the producers, how it got made, how it almost never got seen, and then we'll close with Martin Scorsese's tribute at the American Film Institute's Lifetime Achievement Award. And Scorsese's words were just spectacular. But let's go back to the 2,000-year-old man.
Nothing to do. We had no jobs, don't you see?
What other jobs were there? There must have been something else besides hitting a tree with a piece of stick.
Hitting a tree with a piece of stick was already a good job. You couldn't get that job, you know?
What job?
Mainly was sitting and looking in the sky was a big job. And another job was watching each other was one thing. That was light work, looking at each other.
What language did you speak at that
time? They spoke rock. Basic rock.
Basic rock. Yeah. That was before Hebrew.
Yeah, but it was 200 years before Hebrew. It was the rock language or rock talk.
Could you give us an example of that?
Hey, put that, don't throw that rock at me. Put that rock. Hey, what are you doing with the rock there? Call a policeman, for God's sake.
See.
Put the rock away.
I see.
That was the rock.
Now, do you remember your Hebrew, sir?
Yes, I
would you
I think
to
I remember it fluently.
Because I understand the modern Hebrew is different from the
Yes, it differs in some of the phonetic alliterations and patterns.
Yes.
Yes.
Can we hear an example of the ancient Hebrew?
The very ancient Hebrew is... Oh, hi there. Hello. Hello there, how are you? I'm all right, how are you?
That's English.
Oh, wait.
Do you remember any Hebrew?
Very little, I think. I don't think I remember it. I must have forgot a great deal of it.
I think you forgot it all, sir.
Maybe all, yes. Maybe all.
Yes.
It's thousands of years since I needed it.
Thousands of years since he needed it. This is Lee Habib, Mel Brooks, and Carl Reiner, the 2,000-year-old man. Just go up to YouTube and click that and watch the whole thing. Because it's also watching Mel Brooks that's so remarkable. What he did with his body, what he did with his face. You know, Robin Williams relied on Jonathan Winter's act. But let me tell you, there's a lot of Mel Brooks in him, too. When we come back, more on the life of Mel Brooks. This day in history, he was born in 1926. We'll be right back. And that was from The Elephant Man, which Mel Brooks produced and gave David Lynch the nod as director. A stunning piece of work and showed a serious side to Brooks. And even his seminal work had a serious side. And I think that's the producers. I think you can't not, well, pick any other movie. And it was serious because he was satirizing a monster who had decimated so many of his people. And who else but to take apart Hitler piece by piece in a comedy than Mel Brooks? And in a scene from The Producers, actors Gene Wilde and Zero Mostel are discussing what would become the premise of the film itself. You can make more with a flop than you can with a hit.
It's absolutely amazing. But under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit. Yes, it's quite possible. If he were certain that the show would fail, a man could make a fortune.
Yes?
Yes, what?
What you were saying. Keep talking.
What was I saying?
You were saying that under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit.
Yes, it's quite possible.
You keep saying that, but you don't tell me how. How can a producer make more money with a flop than he could with a hit?
Well, it's simply a matter of creative accounting. Let's assume, just for the moment, that you are a dishonest man.
Assume away.
It's very easy. You simply raise more money than you really need.
What do you mean?
Well, you did it yourself, only you did it on a very small scale.
What'd I do?
You raised $2,000 more than you needed to produce your last play.
So what? What did it get me? I'm wearing a cardboard belt.
Well, that's where you made your mistake. You didn't go all the way. You see, if you were really a bold criminal, you could have raised $1 million.
But the play cost me only $60,000 to produce.
And how long did it run?
One night.
You see? Do you see what I'm trying to tell you? You could have raised $1 million, put on a $60,000 flop, and kept the rest.
But what if the play was a hit?
Well, then you'd go to jail. See, once the play's a hit, you have to pay off all the backers. And with so many backers, there could never be enough profits to go around. Get it?
So in order for this scheme to work, we'd have to find a surefire flop.
What scheme?
What scheme? Your scheme, you bloody little genius.
I meant no scheme. I merely posed a little academic accounting theory. It was just a thought.
Bloom, worlds are turned on such thoughts.
So they set out to find the worst actors to make sure their horrible play, written by a Nazi, is a failure. In this scene, they're searching for the worst possible actor to play Hitler. And the name of this young actor is Lorenzo Sandoboy.
Love power. The power of a little flower. You don't think about no little flowers. Oh, no. All you think about is guns. If everybody in the world today had a flower instead of a gun, there would be no wars. There would be one big smell in. Just a flower. To my flower, man. Hurt it. Like everything else. Like everything else. No flower.
That's our Hitler!
And it was. And they take the show to Broadway. And in one of the most hilarious scenes ever in movies from The Producers is when the cast of the play, with a horrified audience watching, start singing Springtime for Hitler.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Two steps, one new step today.
audience is silent.
Their mouths are open.
It's classic. And here in this scene, the producers hide from their audience. Usually it's Elaine's across the street or some other bistro in the theater district. And they're hiding from their audience during intermission because they're embarrassed by what they think was a horrible play. To their surprise, well, the audience, it turns out they loved it.
It's intermission. Quick! Hide your faces. You'll tear us to pieces.
Whiskey sours, please. Well, so far, that's about one of the funniest things I've ever seen on Broadway. I never laughed so much in my life. Hysterics. Absolutely hysterics. I thought I'd slit my sides. Take it easy. I don't panic.
There are a lot of plays on this street. They aren't necessarily talking about springtime for Hitler.
Would you ever believe in a million years you'd ever love a show called Springtime for Hitler? Hey, come on, let's get back. If the second act is anything like the first, this will run for 5 years.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
According to Mel Brooks, the producers was not well received by the powers that be in Hollywood and was thus not given proper distribution. As a result, the film itself was an immediate flop. Here, Mel Brooks talks about how the night after the premiere was the worst night of his life.
When I got back that night, my wife said, "You're white. What happened?" And I explained slowly. I couldn't sleep. We stayed up reading to each other all night from different books just to get through the night. It was the worst night of my life.
The film was put on the shelf and forgotten for several years until actor, writer, director, and all-around wonderkind Paul Mazursky was hosting Peter Sellers at a dinner party at his house where they were supposed to watch a Fellini film. When the time came to watch the movie, it was missing. So they watched a copy of the producers instead. It was this accident that gave the producers a new life. Here is Paul Mazursky with that story.
Peter finally says, "Well, let's see the Vitellone." And he says, "Charles, we're ready for the Vitellone." And he hits the squawk box. And there's no answer for about 10 seconds. And then you hear Adakov says, "Mr. Sellers, I ain't got no Vitellone. What's a Vitellone?" "Vitellone, Fellini's Vitellone." And I suddenly realized I didn't bring the film. I thought they would have ordered it. He says, "There's no, what's happened?" And my wife said, "Does anybody want any spaghetti?" And she picks up the cup. He says, "I don't want any spaghetti and I don't want any vitelloni. Ever, ever, ever. I don't want it. Ever." And just then you hear the voice come out of the squawk box saying, "I ain't got no vitelloni, but I got some movie here. I don't think I'm supposed to show it, but who's going to know? It's something by this guy, Mel Brooks. It's called The Producers. Put it on, as long as it's not Vitellone. Don't care what it is. Put it on." And the movie goes on. And as the movie unfolds in the first 5 or 6 minutes, we're on the floor. It's hilarious. Zero Mostel. Gene Wilder on the floor. Well, the movie ends, and it's a masterpiece. The lights come up. Peter's in the back. He opens a little book that he has, and he starts dialing the phone. It's midnight in L.A. "Hello? Hello, Joe? I know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm Peter Sellers. I've just seen the greatest film ever, ever, ever. It's even better than Fellini's Vitellone. It's a film called The Producers, and you're the producer. It's by Mel Brooks. It's a work of genius, Joe, and I'm taking on full-page ad in both trades tomorrow. Sorry to have woken you. Thank you."
And here's Mel talking about the newfound success that almost never saw the light of day.
Little by little, I don't know what happened. Sidney Glazer was great. He demanded that the movie be released as per contract. So it had to be released at least in one prime theater in one major city. So in New York, Joe Levine had a deal with the Fine Arts Theater on 58th Street. I believe it was in February. And lo and behold, there was a line around the block. Somehow the word had gotten out that this was a very special movie and that New Yorkers would like it. And it was a hit. And it ran for 1 year. at the Fine Arts Theater. And it ran for close to a year at 9000 Sunset Boulevard. And it ran in Chicago. Those are the three cities. It was an instant hit and kept running.
And because of that hit, we got to experience Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, Silent Movie, High Anxiety, History of the World Part 1, Spaceballs, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and of course, the theatrical version of The Producers. This day in history, Mel Brooks was born in 1926. This is Our American Stories.